This morning, we welcome Reverend Denise Gouch as our speaker. She came to Unitarian Universalism by way of a Roman Catholic youth in a military family and a young adulthood spent at Vanderbilt University, where she almost completed a doctorate in historical theology, but she said she had a bit more fun managing the Divinity School bookstore. I actually first met Denise, and she was managing a bookstore at a Mid-South District event, I think. Was that you? No. Could have been. Wasn't you? Okay. Never mind. So another one of those First UU members, I guess. Denise has been a member of the First UU in Nashville since 2001. She joined the church staff in 2005 as membership coordinator. She earned a Master of Divinity degree from Vanderbilt University in 2011. She was ordained to the UU ministry jointly by the First UU of Nashville and the UU Church of Huntsville in Alabama in 2015. She enjoys sharing life in and out of church with partner David Lewis and their two children. Her primary passion these days is looking for ways to support the growth of Unitarian Universalism in Middle Tennessee and in the Southern region. Reverend Gouch will speak on the topic, Be Still and Know. Let's welcome Reverend Gouch.
Good morning. I'm so pleased to be here with you this morning. And Frank, where's Frank? Yeah, that was a beautiful meditation. Actually, this whole sermon is about trying to find that stillness that lies. How did it say? Beneath the complexity and confusion, or confusion and complexity of our lives. That's my sermon. So we can all just go now. So I've been struggling with stillness, or really more precisely, the lack of it for, a while. There's no lack of books, articles, songs reminding me that stillness is vital to my spirit and even my physical health. But the push and pull of everyday life, that confusion and complexity, well, I know that you know. And yet, I know that when I do not find ways to acknowledge and nourish the part of my being that craves occasional silence, I suffer, and those around me suffer too. I grow tired, distracted, and sometimes ill. I fear that I am inadequate to the task of living my own life, and I lose perspective. My brain forgets that managing the minutiae of my own life very rarely involves life and death stakes. When I decided to preach on the topic of stillness, my mind went immediately to one of my favorite, from long ago, biblical verses, Be still and know that I am God. I'm no longer sure that God is always the best way to name what I or others find in the still points of our lives, but I still find this ancient commandment both compelling and reassuring. It points us in the still center of our beings to a recognition of a reality that is bigger, older, and more stable than the realities of our individual lives. It's a challenging instruction, perhaps, particularly in our own cultural setting, which values busyness and production while fearing emptiness and nothingness. This idea of stillness led me also, I'm back in the Hebrew Bible, for some reason. It leads me back to the story from the Hebrew Bible that centers in the translations of my youth on a still small voice that the prophet Elijah hears on a mountain. And I want to read that story from 1 Kings, chapter 19, to you this morning. But first, I want to give you a little bit of background to that story because I think it's very interesting. So before this story opens with Elijah out in the desert on a mountaintop, Elijah's been very busy. He's been following instructions from the Lord. His arch enemy, Ahab, the king of Israel, has married Jezebel and established her native worship of Baal, who's a competing god to the god of the Hebrews, in the kingdom of Israel. And the text says that Jezebel and Ahab have done more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than had all the kings of Israel who were before him. Over a period of 3 years, Elijah has prophesied a drought, gone into hiding, performed a few miracles, and come out of hiding to have a very dramatic public showdown with the priests of Baal, the conclusion of which brought both the death of Baal's prophets at Elijah's hands, and the end of the drought. It's a very, very dramatic story. And you might think that Ahab would be grateful for some rain, but he wasn't particularly grateful. And here's our story. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life. He went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. "It is enough now. Take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. At that place he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, and now this he is the word of the Lord, not Elijah, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way." So he set out from there. So when my search for stillness took me back to this half-remembered story with a still small voice at its center, I found some curious things when I read that text. In a newer translation, I should mention. First, there's an awful lot of movement and not stillness in this story. Second, as I've been saying, many newer English translations do not contain the reference to stillness or the idea of a voice. The original Hebrew text literally reports that after the wind, the earthquake, and the fire, Elijah hears a sound of thin silence. In the text I read, it was sheer silence. This prophet regularly receives verbal instructions from the God of Israel, the same God who communicates with the people by ways of signs involving fire and rain and destruction of enemies. But the story points to this thin silence as the epicenter of an extraordinary encounter between the prophet and his God. Although ancient Greek-speaking translators added a comment, which was retained in the older English translations of my youth, they added a comment to the effect that God was still in that was in the still small voice and not in the preceding meteorological excitements. That assurance, like the small voice itself, is not in the original Hebrew text, which raises, but does not answer, the question of what Elijah encountered in that silence. In typical Unitarian Universalist fashion, I'm not really much interested in trying to come up with a definitive answer to that question. But in reading the lines of dialogue that frame this dramatic central point, I'm struck by a third unexpected and curious thing about this story. Nothing seems to change in Elijah's attitude as a result of the sheer silence. Before this silent epiphany, God asks, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah responds with a rather whiny, somewhat overstated litany of his troubles. Afterwards, God poses the same question and receives the exact same answer. I think it's almost word for word. Nothing in Elijah's situation or in his evaluation of it has changed. And yet, immediately after this, Elijah gets a new set of instructions. And although before his pilgrimage into the desert he had lain down wanting to die, he now goes forth to continue his prophetic career and find his successor. Something about that experience of silence provided what Elijah needed to be able to continue his life. And I propose that perhaps this story is paradigmatic for all of us. Recognizing our need for experiences of silence or stillness leads me to three questions. One, how can we be still? Two, what is it that we know in the experience of stillness? And three, why bother? I'll clue you in at the start, I am very thoroughly UU, that I don't know answers to these questions. I'm quite certain both that the answers will be different for different people and that the answers have varied for me at different points in my own life. But here's sort of where I am at the moment. In considering the how-to of being still, I have a three-part. I don't know what it is about three parts. I was trained as a medievalist. Maybe that's what it is. But I have a three-part working description of what stillness entails. First, stillness represents a cessation, a stopping of all sorts of activity, physical, mental, and emotional. Second, for human beings, I think stillness requires solitude. We are such social beings that the presence of others almost always causes some movement in our souls or psyches. And third, stillness is best found in silence, preferably both within and without. Now, having laid out these requirements, I'm kind of tempted to throw up my hands in defeat at the prospect of trying to find an experience of stillness. Obviously, not many of us can manage to be completely still, silent, and alone for significant lengths of time. This is an ideal that I doubt can ever be achieved, let alone sustained. We very rarely have control over the noises in our environment, and sometimes we aren't able to limit the intrusions of others into our space and time. For me, I think of being a parent, especially when children are shorter. Even if we could control all the external factors, we have, in fact, far less control over our own selves than we often wish to acknowledge. I don't know about you, but I find it just about impossible to stop thinking. Although I have become fairly proficient in reading about the idea of observing one's thoughts instead of being controlled by them. But I should note that's probably sort of much the same way that I'm really good at reading about planning menus or building a deck on the back of my house without so much actually doing those things. At times, I find it painfully distracting to be physically still. And though I've been well coached in the control of my emotions, life teaches me that that goal is both impossible and often unhelpful. However, overwhelming evidence from cultures and religious traditions around the world points to a basic human need for stillness, as well as to the possibility of seeking it in the midst of busy, busy lives. Classic spiritual texts and popular media alike provide us with a menu of innumerable techniques for achieving stillness, for entering into silence, for connecting with the center of our beings. You are probably familiar with many of them, and it's kind of fun to make a list. You do meditation, which of course generates its own long list of how-to options. Prayer, pilgrimage, reading or study, worship, repetitive movement of all sorts. I didn't put crocheting on my list, but I could have. Crocheting, knitting, needlework, walking, running, swimming, dancing, these are all repetitive movement that actually can open into a different kind of stillness. There's breathing with attention, yoga, projects which combine focused physical movement with just enough mental engagement to eliminate or drown out a certain amount of mental and emotional chatter, maybe cooking or manual labor or playing in a band or orchestra. And then there's the creation and appreciation of art of all sorts. Many, many people find the experience of being outside to be conducive to stillness and silence. Hiking, boating, spider watching, fishing. All can be recommended as activities which might open onto an experience of stillness, even though they involve a certain amount of movement and can certainly be practiced in ways that lead to busyness instead of stillness. And although I've identified solitude as a crucial component of stillness, both observation and personal experience tell me that sometimes we can coax ourselves into stillness more easily in company than alone. One of the first things I loved about being Unitarian Universalist was the ability, previously unknown in my Sunday morning experience, to sit together in silence during worship, just as we did earlier. On the one hand, it seems to me that any of these activities, as well as many more that you may think of that I haven't mentioned, could be undertaken as spiritual disciplines and might, especially if undertaken with regular practice and focused attention, provide opportunities for moments of silence and nourishing stillness. And yet, clinging to the testimony of seekers before us and considering this list of potentially stillness-inducing activities, it seems to me that the trick, besides a willingness to experiment, may be to hold that impossible ideal of stillness in mind while ignoring our cultural tendency to seek perfection and instead pursuing balance. So if your life is heavy on physical movement, sitting still might be in order. If you sit at a desk all day, movement might be best, although you may need to discern whether you should climb a mountain, swim laps, or stretch in a yoga class. The practice that works to bring you to a place of nurturing stillness may be counterproductive for me. I find I am pretty constantly exploring what works for me, and you'll have to figure out for yourself what is best for you. What sort of stillness deficit do you have in your life? Perhaps you might experiment with ways to detach from your thoughts, or gain distance from your emotions, or rest your body, and see what new things you learn. And so, we come finally to the question of what is found in stillness. The short answer in biblical terms is often God. But other traditions apply other names, many other names. Oneness, true self, the web, emptiness, the center, Tao, peace, not doing, compassion, interbeing, nirvana. Most traditions insist that the reality being named here is in fact beyond the power of language to describe. Pinning it down in language seems futile. We are liable to find the results of our efforts seem like dry, dead leaves in contrast to the green vibrancy of our peak moments of experience. My personal favorite statement of this principle comes from the Tao Te Ching, which begins with the words, Tao called Tao is not Tao. But every religious tradition I know reminds us that some truths are very, very difficult to express clearly and perhaps impossible to communicate in any complete form. Whether these differences in nomenclature point to differences in what is really experienced, to differences in linguistics and culture, or even to individual differences in temperament and intellect, might be an interesting question to explore. But spurred on by my third question, the so what question, I'm struck by the impossibility of predicting what any individual person will take away from an experience of stillness. The takeaway seems to vary from person to person and moment to moment. The experience of stillness may always be, as the wisdom traditions of the world suggest, a return to a true self or a remembering of a foundational reality or truth that underlies our everyday lives. I really love the statement of it in the meditation, the stillness that lies beneath the confusion. But however we understand it, the impact of that experience and the expression of that understanding do vary widely. What I suspect does not vary, and the reason we need to attend to stillness and to cultivate it in our lives, is that the experience of stillness will affect the rest of our lives and the world around us. Stillness is not about our doings, but neither is it antithetical to them. It is the center of the wheel around which the spokes and rims roll through the world, the empty space within that makes the pot useful. Because our world is full of noise, like, oh, I don't know, this afternoon there's going to be a Super Bowl, and there's all kinds of noise there. Because of all this noise, our lives are full of questions and problems which engage us but are not truly our own. To be still in most times and places is countercultural. It gives us perspective on the cultural conditioning that can make our lives more convenient, but perhaps also less free. As we become more aware in silence, in stillness, of how things really are, of who we really are, then we have choices available that were not available before. When we are able to make choices with integrity, that is, choices that flow from the truth of who we are, however we understand that, instead of choices founded on the fearful stories we tell ourselves when we lose our sense of connection to the web of existence, the benefit accrues not only to us as individuals, but to the whole. When we move authentically in the world, we are bound to be more effective and our efforts are more sustainable. With a little stillness at the center, we can face our lives and the company of the others who surround us with equanimity and compassion. As the Tao Te Ching puts it, in words which might seem to you either elegant or blunt, Tao endures, your body dies, there is no danger. Although it's not usually expressed so baldly, many, many wisdom traditions include some variation of the admonition, be not afraid. Like Elijah, who really is in a difficult, confusing, complex, dangerous place, we need from time to time to enter into stillness and be reminded that we can touch and rely upon a bigger reality than that of our own limited existence, so that we can find the courage to take the next small step that lies in front of us. May we each and all have what we need. Blessed be and amen.